You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. Serious talk about the sacred book. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Everybody, welcome to our last podcast of season two. And this is a retrospective, which is a fancy way of saying looking back at good moments and good times and things that made an impact on us.
Yeah, so this is our, I think this will come out before Christmas. So Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas.
This is our Christmas present to you, a recap of season two.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knete ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Lebara ist ja irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 Gigabyte für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee, das wäre auch schön blöd. Lebara, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter lebara.de.
So yeah, I think, you know, we want to come back to this question. Again and again we come back to, what is the Bible and what do we do with it? And so we want to just look at this past season through the lens of those questions.
Yeah.
And one of the first things that sticks out in my mind is something I said, I think, in probably the first season around this idea that all theology has an adjective. There's a perspective. And I think of folks like Will Gaffney that really hit home for me how valuable different socioeconomic, race, class, all these different perspective or experiences shape how you look at the Bible, and that can be such a value to the community of faith.
Yeah, not just, oh, now I understand you, but it actually, you know, taking into consideration the other or marginal groups will actually affect how you think, which I think is why it's so scary to some people, I guess. But that's absolutely true. You don't look at the Bible exactly. Even if you don't agree with everything somebody says, you don't look at the Bible again the same way. And that's a huge thing, and I think a very, very positive thing for the church in general to sort of embrace.
Yeah. Were there other podcast guests that we had that did that for you, that helped you see the Bible from a different angle, a different lens?
Well, I think language is big, and Jonathan Merritt was on about, you know, the use of sacred words and making words sacred again, and using just different language that people can reconnect with the Christian faith rather than the old words that have lost their meaning. And that struck me too, because that is basically the history of the Bible, really, is already functioning in that world where when you translate from one language to another, even before the time of Jesus, or if when times change and cultures change and you need to update is not the best way to put it, but you need to contextualize the language of the Bible so it means something to others. That's just the way it's always been done. And, you know, there's a Bible translation out there, I just won't name it, but in talking about Romans chapter 3 and how Paul is talking about language of like atonement, and this translation boasts about how they're not caving into culture. They're using good words, good biblical words like propitiation. And I remember thinking, that's not a biblical word. That's an English word, actually. And it's already an interpretation of what's going on there. So, you know, there's all theology has an adjective. All translations and all words have context. And there's actually nothing more faithful to the biblical tradition than a willingness to re-examine the language that you use. And Jonathan's book was all about that. And I think it was just a fantastic corrective to a lot of things that ail us.
Well, and it's thinking that it's showing how to crystallize a particular language. Well, it's really foolish, right? So we do this in English and we think we're somehow like the King James only people who somehow are ordaining an English version without realizing that that's already an interpretation, it's already a translation, and we have more and more updating to go. So I feel like anytime we crystallize the language around the Bible, we're just asking for it to die.
Yeah, we're leaving it in the past, absolutely.
There's a way to bring the Bible to the present without updating the language, like, let me know. I'd love to know how you do that. That would feel better. But I don't know how you get it. We're human. We use language, and the language you use now, I mean, try to read a Bible that was in English in the 1300s and see if you can make sense of most of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But people will say, yeah, but the original, like New Testament's written in Greek. Yeah, okay. As far as we know, and we don't have the originals, but leaving that aside for the moment, that Greek language is still, you know, if the New Testament writers were writing in Greek, but if Jesus was, for example, speaking Aramaic, you know, how close are we? And is there a difference between Aramaic and Greek? And not only that, but is there a difference between first century Judea and, let's say, 7th century Judah? And the answer to that is yes, there are large differences between that. And so, you know, you have to update. And again, update is sort of an anathema term for many people. And I get that, you know, like you don't want the gospel to sort of rise and fall on the whims of culture, all that kind of stuff. But I just think it's this beautiful thing about the Christian faith that built into it is the inescapableness of incarnational thinking, because it's never an abstract that's up there and out there someplace. It's never a thing in the past that you have to go back and sort of reiterate the past. We're always challenged to bring the past and our present into some sort of conversation. And the only way really to do that is to change language.
Well, I'm going to ask you this, and I expect you to give a great answer for it.
All right.
How then do we avoid this? Anything goes, right? Because what I hear is, it's all fine and good. Like, I think we can get people to say, yeah, in the Bible itself, we see this updating. But then there's always the argument like, well, okay, but they were being guided by the Spirit of God. And they, since it's so far in the past, we can sort of have this mystical idea that somehow back then they could update it because God was guiding that process. But today, if we did that, we would just like fall off the rails, because I think there was maybe more of a mechanistic understanding of how the Spirit of God worked back then. So we can't imitate what they were doing, because we don't have this zapped Spirit of God that's sort of guiding that process. So today, how do we not fall off the rails, or anything goes, or just go on the whims of culture?
Well, I would question the entire premise of the way you phrase the question. And I know there's a common way of thinking about
classic
it.
Classic deflection.
No, because, you know, if you, I mean, this is a big thing. This is like a podcast or two into itself. But if you look at how the language changed within the Old Testament, or from the Old Testament Hebrew period to the Greek period, you don't always get the impression these people were guided by the Spirit of God. Like, what the heck are they doing with this text? This is no way. This, how do they get this? You know, and it's this beautiful humanity of Scripture that I think that fact alone is enough of an encouragement for us to think, you know, we, in a sense, we're doing the same thing. We're trying to, let me say, adapt the tradition for the current moment. And like, when have you gone too far? I think that's a great question. I just don't think we can curtail that theological question or dismiss it quickly, because it might be difficult and we're not exactly sure where it's going to wind up. And I think it's I don't know too many people are saying, hey, let's just destroy the tradition with new language. The tension is always, I love this tradition, I want to stay connected to it, but some things just don't make sense. You know, one example, I mean, this is anecdotal, I've never experienced this, but the old story about the missionary who goes someplace to some country that's not America, and they talk about the Lamb of God, and they don't know what a lamb is. So, I mean, that's maybe a little, you know, not the best example, but it's still, I think it's still an illustrative example that they have to like replace with a goat or something, because they just don't talk that way. And the thing is, well, what's the big deal? Well, lamb theology is not a tiny thing in the New Testament. It's there. But do you want the people to understand it or not? And that's the theory behind certain English translations, like, you know, the NIV is a very dynamic equivalent, they sort of call it. It's like it's trying to stick with words, but also trying to be dynamic in how you express that in ways that people will understand, which is a translation philosophy that I very much agree with. And a wooden translation, like the New American Standard Version, is not more biblical, because it's trying to be much more mechanical with words if those words are not helpful to people.
Right. Right.
You know, and that's why I just think, you know, this is, so talk about perspectives, you know, I mean, just the whole language we use to talk about God and the whole biblical language we use and how we have to rethink what it means in our culture, you know, it's Christianese, right, Jared? Like, it's all over the place, and it means nothing to people, like righteousness, redemption, you know, even salvation, you know, we take these things for granted. And what Jonathan was doing is like, okay, how do we talk about these things today that, you know, uses different language for the real purpose of reclaiming the tradition, not dismissing it? And that's risky. That's theology is a risky creative endeavor. That's just it.
Well, it's funny that you use that, because I was about to just say there's always this tension between discovery and creation. Are we creating it, or are we discovering it? And I think it's always this little bit of both. Like, my tradition growing up, everything was about discovery. It's all there. It's almost like you go on this hunt for dinosaur bones, but since we don't believe in dinosaurs, we have to go on this other kind of hunt, right? And really, we're just discovering what's in the Bible. The challenge with that is we don't live back then. And so we have to always be creating as well. And it's sort of, I almost think of it like a recipe. Like, as a Christian, how much of my recipe, what's the ratio of discovery to creation? What's the ratio of preservation of old traditions and innovation into the future? And that's a wisdom question for me. That's a wisdom question. We have to be wise about that. It's not black and white. We can't say, well, here's the recipe for all time, 70% innovation, 30% preservation. It depends.
It definitely is a wisdom question. And I think what a reason why people might feel uncomfortable with the whole innovative side of things, not the discovery side, is we just sort of think like if we leave the language and the way it was done in the past, we're sort of leaving God behind and we're sort of charting our own course, which is interesting, but I don't think that's persuasive, at least not to me. What if God is out in front of us, and what if we sort of see that kind of thinking already in the Bible? Like, God is out in front of the people, where ways of thinking that are in the biblical tradition are rethought and massaged, and in some cases pretty radically rethought, because times and circumstances change. And that's much more than simply saying, well, you're letting culture or time dictate what God says. Well, no, but just the way language is set up. And maybe what if God is actually a part of that process somehow? And it's okay just to try your best and to explain this scripture and this tradition as best as you can when and where you live.
What if God is bigger than the Bible and is also in culture? And what if, frankly, culture gets it right a lot of times?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think of the history of, we went, as Christians, I don't think you can debate the fact that we kind of went kicking and screaming with slavery. We went kicking and screaming with women. Equality of women. We went kicking and screaming with LGBTQ, and it's like we don't really ever learn that maybe God's ahead of the curve, maybe that God's bigger than just what's in the church and sort of this preservationist thinking, that maybe God is innovative and God is creating new ways of being in the world.
And maybe God's little joke is that, okay, you want a Bible? Okay, I'll give you a Bible. I'll make it so old that there's no way you can just follow this. I'll make it so diverse. I will make it so unlike anything you really want, just to drive home the point that you cannot absolve yourself of this responsibility to, I think, do theology. That's really what it comes down to.
Right. Well, and I think this is tied into, you know, another point that we were talking about earlier on how we think about the Bible and how we use the Bible as a weapon. Right. So we had a number of episodes where we wouldn't maybe have said it that strongly, but I think there were a number of episodes with how we can weaponize the text and how whenever I think of the connection, because I think of people who are all about preservation can tend to kind of lash out in ways, maybe even unconsciously or unintentionally, mm-hmm. hurtful ways when you start to mess with the thing that keeps me feeling safe and secure, the thing that's unchanging and keeps the status quo.
To protect. And so you use the old language as non-negotiable at every point. And sometimes people's experiences push them in different directions. Well, you shouldn't let your experience affect how you think about God. I don't know. I see that throughout the Bible, where people's experiences affect how they think about God. You know, does God like Assyrians or hate them? Well, it's Jonah or Nahum. Take your pick. You know, does God punish the sins or bless people in a multi-generational way? Well, Ten Commandments, yes. Ezekiel, no. So, you know, it's not like the Bible is full of contradictions. They're really showing that the necessary openness, I think, that the people of God have to have for what's happening in their moment and not always reading it through the lens of past moments. And when you do, like you said, Jared, the tone can become very belligerent with people. And it's not that you can't debate stuff, right? We
right.
can debate things all the time, and that's fine, and strongly disagree. But it slides over sometimes too quickly, almost immediately, to demonizing other people and slandering them, or really just making their lives miserable. We had a couple guests on like that.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Lust auf besonders feine Weihnachten? Erlebe einzigartigen Genuss mit Rewe Feine Welt. Diese Woche zum Beispiel Rewe Feine Welt Schweizer Käse Trüffeltraum mildwürzig, je 150 Gramm Packung nur 3,49 Euro. Oder Rewe Feine Welt italienischer Prosciutto Crudo, roher Schinken mit Meersalz behandelt, mindestens 18 Monate gereift, je 100 Gramm Packung nur 4,29 Euro. Festlich sparen mit Genuss. Rewe, dein Markt.
Well, and yeah, the question of what are we making judgments based on? And I keep going back to when we had Jen. So I think Jen was what we launched.
We call season her Jen. Two. Her real name is Jen Hatmaker.
Jen Hatmaker. When we launched season two, I think we got a lot of push. I mean, I remember getting a lot of pushback on her statement that a part of her decision in changing her mind about the Bible and on some crucial issues was the fruit of the people that she saw holding yeah. different issues. And I was just surprised by the amount of pushback that's like, well, the fruit isn't, that's not a good argument. And I was just really surprised by that. So it makes me think of what are we judging these things by? And I think the fruit of, you know, you mentioned kind of going belligerent and going to demonizing. I think that is important when we're talking about if the certain way of looking at the Bible and interpreting it consistently leads to a certain belligerence, I think that is important.
Yeah, and, you know, we were, I mean, I've heard that this a lot, and we were part of a tradition at one point in our lives where I can't tell you how many times I've heard that theology sort of exists on its own and right interpretation exists on its own. And if you're sort of a real jerk about it, that's irrelevant. We will tolerate that in the interest of theological truth, but you know, Jen's saying, you know, if it produces bad fruit, I think Jesus says something very similar to that in the Sermon on the Mount, that you can actually tell the value of a teacher by the fruit it produces. And the fruit that it produces has nothing to do with passing an ordination exam or doing well in a theology exam. It has to do with what kind of a human you are.
Well, and it actually goes deeper to that idea we've talked about several times, which is we've privileged our minds. We privilege a belief set or ideas that we assent to rather than our behavior. And yeah, so that's what I understand by that is, well, we can't judge things by the fruit. We have to judge it by something more objective. And that means something like a faith statement that I can sign off on. And I think that's a mistake.
Where does that come from? Like where... That wasn't always the case in the history of the church, I think.
Yeah. I wonder if we get just twinges of that in Augustine. I'm not sure.
That was a long time ago.
That was a long time
ago.
But definitely in the modern period.
But I think, you know, definitely the modern period, because I think for those of our brothers and sisters who might be prone towards reactive belligerence, I don't think they're getting it from Augustine. I think they're getting it from a more immediate setting. And like we're just in a state of watching your borders really carefully. You know, and I have my own pop analysis of that, which may be 1/10 true, but I think a lot does go back to the 19th century and Darwin and biblical archaeology, which sort of made the Bible less special in a way, you know.
But why are the borders, even that though, like even if we were about borders, why are the borders we're drawing about certain beliefs and not behaviors? Like, why are we not like, yeah, we're all about boundaries, and ours is not committing adultery. That's like the thing that we hang our hat on. You don't see a lot of behavior-based boundary making. It is still this belief set making.
The intellectual system,
right.
I guess.
Yeah.
Well, again, more pop analysis, which Reformation historians will probably want to beat me senseless, but not in a belligerent way, in a kind way. But, you know, there are elements in the Protestant Reformation that coincides with the rise of science and analysis. And, you know, to know something is to analyze it. And you can do that with the biblical text as you can with the physical world. And one thing that Martin Luther did, which is doesn't always get the press that it deserves, is he sort of brought the German language together where people could actually start reading the Bible, because he translated into German and not just Latin for people, because he wanted people to read their Bible. And many people connect with that things like the rise of the German universities and the study of the Bible, which then becomes an object of analysis and science. And that has a hold on, you know, European and then American thinking. And then there's a reaction to that, which we typically call fundamentalism of the 19th century and early 20th century, which is fueled by the same notion of analysis and getting the right answer from this text. In other words, it's entirely an intellectual battle.
Hey, normal people, Pete here. Just a quick break. First, if you like what we're doing, please rate us on iTunes. I could back that up with plenty of Bible verses, but there's just no time. Also, consider supporting our work at Patreon for as little as $1 a month, cheaper than the price of a very bad cup of coffee. You'll have access to videos, early announcements, book clubs, an active Slack group of kindred spirits, and more. And that's patreon.com/thebiblefornormalpeople. Finally, a huge thanks to our producers group at Patreon. They get on calls with us and give us great feedback. If you like what we're doing, thank them. If not, just blame Jared. So thank you to Logan Jansen, Matthew Tringali, Christopher Lake, Josh Hamilton, Kevin Marshall, Robert Cochran, Tyler Tankersley, Robert Auth, Austin Hill, and Patrick Antos. We couldn't do what we do without you. Now back to the podcast.
And even, you know, even the bad guys, the quote liberals, who were like amazing, wonderful human beings, that was immediately discounted. And on the other side, the Orthodox people, in terms of their beliefs, their behaviors were discounted. Like, we don't care how nasty they are. We know they're right. They're on our side. And I've experienced, as you have too, Jared, many, many times, belligerence is ignored in the interest of an intellectual system. And, you know, the more I think about that, the more absurd it is to me. It just that just doesn't sound Jesus-y to me. I'm sorry. So we use the Bible against others, and you know, who hasn't done that on some level? But, you know, a couple of guests, Trey Pearson and Jen Hatmaker especially, were very articulate about some of those things. And Brian McLaren too, you know, about weaponizing the Bible, as only Brian can say that. You know, it's just it's true. You know, we and that's not good Orthodox faithful theology. That's very disruptive and divisive.
I think you can extrapolate from that also. It's tied to how we see God. Is God there to confirm everything we already believe and to protect, or is God there to critique what we believe, to push us out of our comfort zone, to challenge us? And so one of the things I appreciate about the prophetic tradition and the prophets is it sets up a God who isn't there just to protect our boundaries, but to challenge that and to say, hey, you've co-opted me in this process and now are using the temple rituals, or you're using the priestly class that we've set up here, or you're using the monarchy to now oppress people, and that's not okay. And I always go back to Joshua. I love, and I think it's Joshua 5, where I think it's Joshua who comes up and got done with his battle, and there's this random person there, the angel of the Lord says, "Which side are you on?" And the angel says, "Neither." And I love that. It's like neither. I think we need a neither theology where God's not on my side or your side.
There's
a book title. That's right. You're already assuming a divide, and us versus them. And I think this God is the one who says neither. And that's an unsettling thing.
Well, what people will point out, though, and I think this is something to consider, though, is that there is insider-outsider language in the Bible. You find it.
I just skipped those parts.
You skipped those parts. But first of all, I think it's okay to skip those parts. But even so, that suggests us, again, this diversity in the Bible. And it's not like you have to get to the New Testament for Jesus to fix it. You have that discussion already happening in the Old Testament. And that's something for us to just keep in mind when we get sort of like – in other words, to be theologically belligerent, you also have to be very selective in your use of Scripture. And is there room for God to act in ways that are so outside of our frame of reference, we just want to call it heterodoxy or heresy? And again, I don't want to say this is an easy equation, but that's sort of what they said about Jesus and Paul, right? I mean, it's hard to escape some of the tectonic shifts in thinking that you see in the New Testament. It's not against the Old Testament. These guys were Jews, but they still said things that rightly got people riled up and that were not consistent with biblical teaching. You know, circumcision, yeah, if you want to. You know, dietary restrictions, yeah, not really. You know, and then a dying and rising Messiah makes no sense in Judaism. So it's like, it's almost like the whole Christian tradition is founded on innovation, which hacked people off, right?
But it's very hard to see it as innovation when you have 2,000 years of preservation from where we're sitting.
Right. Right.
And that can be a challenge to understand that.
And also, you know, if you have this notion, like you're saying, that the church has pretty much existed the way I understand it now for 2,000 years, and I represent pretty much historic Christian orthodoxy in how I think. And that may be true in some things, but, you know, students of church history will be very quick to point out that there's been tremendous diversity in the church. That doesn't mean that there are no boundaries whatsoever, but you might be surprised where some of those boundaries are, mm-hmm. You know. And the atonement, I don't know. This, I got like six theories running around inside my head. It's probably all those. But, you know, it's things like that. It's the flexibility of the tradition. And so when people of good faith come along and they say, it may be time for us to rethink X, the first response to that should not be, you're wrong, you're not, quote, biblical. It might be, well, let's see. You may have a point to make. We might have to listen. We're not going to listen just because you say so, but maybe this is a time for us to really talk about things and weigh arguments and really look into issues and how they're affecting people. Maybe that's a better way of doing theology and not weaponizing the Bible.
And I would hope for everyone that we would look at how we all weaponize. I think of weaponize maybe as too strong, but I think of how we defend our insecurities with the Bible.
Because By weaponizing the Bible.
But weaponizing is this very offensive thing. And I think if we took stock of our own insecurities and how we use the Bible to sort of fill those, I think it might help us to be – because I just think there's two different kinds of people for me who disagree with me theologically. There are those who you can tell are genuinely humble in spirit. They don't have a lot of insecurities. They just disagree. And then there are those who are very reactionary and emotionally reactive. And I think there's something going on there. I wish we could be more introspective and see what are those kind of holes in our soul that we're very afraid of getting exposed. And that, I think that's on all sides of the theological spectrum, left and right. And that's, for me, where this Jen's discussion of fruit comes in, is I think if we could look at those behaviors and then look back and say, well, what's going on inside our hearts that's causing that? It's not just an intellectual exercise of good theology, bad theology. If you believe in a vengeful, angry, wrathful God, you will behave vengefully and angry. I think there's something to that. But there's also, I think it's more complicated than that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's two groups that you mentioned. I think the first group contributes to theological engagement. I disagree. Here's why. I don't hate you, but I do disagree.
Right.
And the other is more, and I mean this sincerely, that sounds more like therapy in the best sense of the word, like a real need to be introspective. Like, what makes me tick? Like, why? And this is something, you know, I learned years ago, and I by no means have mastered it, but I think about this a lot. When I'm quickly triggered and jump to anger real fast, I've learned to say, what problem do you have? Like, what is making – it's not that person that's making me angry. There's something going on inside of me, and that's a much harder question to ask. And if we did that, if I did that, I think there'd be a lot less – reactive belligerence. You can still have disagreement and strong debate which is part of the Christian tradition too.
Yeah, which would actually strengthen the diversity if we could come to the table and disagree in these emotionally healthy, maybe is a good way of saying that. Yeah. If we could disagree in emotionally healthy ways, I think we couldn't help but grow stronger in our faith and our different perspective. It kind of ties into, I'm not going to listen to other people's perspectives if I'm not in a place where I can hear it, mm-hmm. where I can hear challenges to the way I've always thought.
Right. Although some challenges are not helpful challenges. They're baiting challenges, you know, but a genuine challenge. I think it's an art to know the difference between the two. But, you know, on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, sometimes the challenges are just...
Well, they're trying to get you. It's the gotcha.
It's a gotcha moment, mm-hmm. you know. And I want to be careful not to do that myself, but you're beyond hope, Jared. You do it all the time on Twitter. It's horrible. Anyway.
Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma. Trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn. Und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
Ah, da ist meine Prime-Bestellung.
Was? Jetzt schon?
Nur eine Sache begeistert so wie die schnelle Lieferung mit Prime. Und zwar das tolle Unterhaltungsangebot von Prime.
Was schauen wir uns an?
Fallout ist zurück mit Staffel 2. Unsere Lieblingshelden kämpfen sich durch die brutale und bizarre Einöde, um dahin zu gelangen, wo alles begann. New Vegas.
Schnelle, kostenlose Lieferung, geniale Unterhaltung und mehr gibt's bei Prime. Für nur 8,99 € pro Monat. Werde jetzt Prime-Mitglied. Die Inhalte können Werbung enthalten. Fortlaufende Mitgliedschaft. Mehr auf amazon.de/prime.
So, okay, listen, there's another thing too that, you know, here at the Bible for Normal People, one reason we started the podcast was to allow really smart people who have studied stuff for a long time sort of bring that to people who maybe don't go to seminary or didn't go to seminary or anything like that. But it's like really interesting and it can actually very positively affect how you look at your faith, how you look at God, stuff like that. So, you know, stuff like, I mean, archaeology, for example, we had
Cynthia Schaefer Elliott
on early in the season. And it just really struck me how looking at the material culture, not texts, but material culture that archaeologists look at, you can see the importance of women in everyday life in Israel that you will not pick up on from reading texts. That it's not that it's just they were written by men. I think that's not the strongest critique. It's that they were written for a particular political and religious. I don't know what's the word I'm looking for here. I don't want to say agenda, but it's more like there's a structure they're trying to build that's theopolitical. And you know, men were pretty much in power, right? I mean, this is the ancient world, but I don't think. I'm not sure if Israelite men live, you know, farming would say, don't talk to me, woman, you're a female, and God says you're less of value to me. It's like, yeah, honey, can you do all the, we won't survive without each other, right? And that's the kind of thing that she brought out, and I thought that was just really, really valuable how there can be a conversation even between the material culture and the textual witness, which is not designed to tell you, like, what was everyday life like? What was your average Israelite doing, you know, in the 7th century BCE? And it, you know, might not be reading Deuteronomy or something.
Well, I appreciated. We had a number, I think, of Mark Smith was another one that painted this picture. And one of the pictures I like is, you know, growing up, I had a sense that the ancient world was very different than the world today in terms of how people believed. Like, somehow they were all amazing believers in God. They were all really, they all had access to God in these ways. And then to hear like Cynthia Schaefer Elliott or Mark Smith talk about, well, there's kind of the adopted religion. There's like the elite religion or the one that gets published.
The official religion.
The official, yeah, the official religion. And then there's what actually was happening. So it's like 300 years from now, people only had access to sermons from prominent pastors and sort of tried to construct what it was like to be an average Christian in America. It's like, well, they're going to get a very skewed picture of that. So I appreciate it. It actually relieves me of the pressure to kind of be like that. It's like, well, there's this, the average person wouldn't have been like that. They would have had, like, with Cynthia Schaefer Elliott, like, they probably would have had mini gods, little statues. You know, of course, if you can't have kids, what does it hurt to pray to the fertility goddess? Right. And it just humanized the scene for me.
For me, it's analogous to how we think of Christmas. You know, if you had archaeologists digging up, let's say, official church documents about Christmas time 3,000-4,000 years from now, and there'd be prayers, and there'd be Mary, and there'd be Jesus, and there would be all sorts of things, maybe wise men, whatever, and this is what we talk about. This is part of our pageants or whatever. And if that's all they knew, that's fine, but they dig a little bit further, and there's this thing called Black Friday that starts the you know, and they're going shopping right away. And who the heck is Santa Claus and Frosty and Rudolph? It's like, you know, the popular religion, so to speak, is not the official religion. And even, you know, so, well, those people aren't really religious. I don't know. I know a lot of people who are actually Christians who, like, love Rudolph, you know, or love Frosty, or, you know, Christmas trees with blinking lights on them or things like that. It's just the official religion and the down-to-earth religion is different. And, you know, the fertility goddesses, like you mentioned, there's a reason why thousands of clay figurines, which probably represent the fertility goddess Asherah, of Canaanite religion, were found in 7th century Judah. Not like 1500 BC Judah, but 7th century Judah. And it's like, well, that's why the prophets were complaining all the time, because these were sinners. And yeah, I guess maybe that's why they were denouncing them, but I can't imagine for these people to say, let's rebel against Yahweh. It's just, this is how you do religion in the ancient world. You have little figurines. And, you know, Yahweh is maybe our supreme God, but the others can't hurt. You know, they might help a little bit because, you know, my neighbor's got great crops and they sacrifice to Asherah. You know, have no other gods before me. Okay, how about next to you or like walking two steps behind you? Can we just do this? And what, you know, what would we do in that ancient world? Well, we'd be like, we're going to get the Bible right. Now, we'd be right in there with the farmers and the
prophets. Well, I mean, I think if you – not to abstract too much, but it's sort of like the – I think I've heard this before. Like, well, yeah, we trust God, but hey, the 401k can't hurt either, right? So right. It's like, yeah, trust God with your future. And so we have that – again, it's sort of that official religion. We have the things that we talk about, but then very practically, we have these other syncretistic – ways of living in the world that are just practically, for them, that was a practical thing. If you want fertility, you want good crops, then yeah, what does it hurt to have this backup practice? And I think we have those. They're just more abstract within sort of a capitalistic society.
There's the ideal, but then there's the actual concrete
right.
world that we live in.
And the thing for me with these podcasts and just the, I guess it's probably the older I get too, is there's something really comforting about not trying to be that ideal version. And having a view of God that says, hey, God's, it's okay. Mm-hmm. It's okay.
Yeah.
Like, we're doing the best we can. There's always going to be the Asherah. There's always going to be the 401k. There's always going to be something in our mm-hmm. culture that is there.
And that's hard to hear if the Bible is this, let's say, bit of revelation that gives you the pure religion, which it sort of does, but it has to do with how you treat widows and orphans and how you're just to other people. That is sort of the pure religion, to love the Lord your God with your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. I mean, I do think that is a distillation of biblical teaching. It's Old and New Testament. Jesus harps on it, right? But if you think of it as that, everything there is equally ultimate. Everything in there, there's no theological discernment needed. You just do all that it says, unless it's really crazy, like stoning a rebellious teenager in Deuteronomy. But some people find a way around that. But, you know, it's the official religion, so to speak. It's like, it's so messy in the Bible. It's, again, it's almost like it's God's way of saying you might have to think through some of this stuff yourself. And what you do now, concretely on earth right here at this moment, it may not look exactly like that official religion, but there you have it.
Well, it makes me think of the French philosopher Jacques Derrida, because he talks about justice, and he distinguishes between kind of justice with the big J and justice with the little J. And justice with the big J, we're just, as humans, we're always going to fall short. Like, we've never seen a perfect instance of justice. But that shouldn't keep us from pursuing small J justice all the time. we're always at the horizon of the big J. We're always right there, but we just are never going to get there. And I think of that too, is thinking of the Bible and these things as love of God, love of neighbor, are always that thing we're going to pursue. And we're always going to fall a little short, but that shouldn't keep us from pursuing that in new ways, in creative ways, in culturally contextual ways. And in some ways, I was thinking about it as you said that, the Bible really is us getting to the point where we realize that that is what it all is about, and then figuring out contextually how we do that in every generation.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Bible deconstructs those bad uses of the Bible that don't take the context into account well enough, which I think is just a wonderful... It takes the pressure off. Like, it's not about memorizing a legal tradition. I mean, Jews have always known better than that anyway, you know, because the legal tradition is so... It is contradictory. It is diverse in the Bible. So you always have to think about it. And, you know, that concrete winds up not being simply a mimicking or repetition of what's written on the page. You always have to think about it. And, again, the Bible itself bears witness to that. So, well... Yeah, I guess, Jared, there are so many angles to this we could touch on. There's just so much that happened in the second season, but I think we probably have to, like, not repeat the entire second season today.
I agree. Well, and we also might want to just do a third season to keep the conversation going. Yeah, I think so.
Okay, if you want.
Yeah, but we should take a little break.
I hadn't even thought about it. Okay, yeah, let's do a third season, whatever.
This is all for show. We've actually already recorded several episodes of season 3, if you're listening to this.
Yeah.
But we're excited to keep the conversation going.
Absolutely, yeah.
We haven't answered it yet. What is the Bible? What do we do with it? I don't think we've answered it.
But we're talking about it. And to quote Miley Cyrus, I think it's the climb.
That's a Miley Cyrus? I wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I only know that because
Here comes the justification.
Not too long ago. Uh-huh. And one of our dogs is named Miley.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, that's from my daughter.
Is it from Miley Cyrus?
Yes. My daughter was a big fan when she was young, and then she left for college. And we're stuck with this idiot dog named Miley, who I just look at and want to kick every day. But I don't, because Miley's a little cutie. My dog, Miley.
Yeah, you are a big softie towards your animals. You're like putting up a big front.
I know.
Yeah.
I have good animals.
All right.
All right, folks. Well, listen, again, thanks for season 2. See you in season 3.
It's coming up. Yeah. Well, and if you get bored between now and the next season, feel free to go back, listen to a lot of these episodes. And if you haven't already, we would really appreciate your support. So head to patreon.com/thebiblefornormalpeople. And for as little as $1 a month, you can keep this show going, help us launch season 3, help us with a lot of other projects. We are really passionate about bringing biblical scholarship to everyday people. And so far, this podcast is one way. We have lots of other ideas we'd love to get off the ground in the future. So while you're sitting around with your days off, drinking your... What do you drink over Christmas? Do you drink eggnog? That's gross. But as you're drinking that, go head to patreon.com/thebiblefornormalpeople. Help us out.
Absolutely. Thanks, people.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.